Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
One of these movies was nominated for Best Original Song. That's it. It won a Golden Globe for Best Actor, and, you know, it grossed $195 million against a $40 million budget. The other one of these movies grossed $905 million on a $50 million budget. It's the sixth highest grossing movie of 2018, set an all-time record for biopics, and was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Editing, Best Sound Mixing, Best Sound Editing, and won all but Best Picture.
And when you think about that...
Which one do you think won?
And which one is which? It really just makes you...
Makes you question
wanna
things.
Want to die a yes. little bit.
I am dreading and... very excited to talk about one of these movies and one of the other. It's, I don't know.
I'm excited for both of them. However, I would just like to say that our guest today made the brilliant, brilliant suggestion that yes. we do this as a compare and contrast episode, which I have to say I really appreciate, because otherwise we would just spend the two separate episodes talking about the other movie.
Yes.
for half of it. So really efficient.
And I think, not to spoil anything, definitely tipped their hand about which one they care a little bit more about.
Yes. We are joined today by Eric Anderson of Awards Watch. Hello. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I am really, really excited to talk about both of these because I love one of them. So I would love talking about it. And I hate one of them. And I love talking about it.
I feel like that's the thing. It's like, it's so... Let's just get it out of the way.
Yeah.
We're talking about Rocket Man. We're talking about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Back to back.
Dexter Fletcher
musical biopics.
Ish.
Yes, sort of.
One of them was also directed by a pedophile, which we'll just get out of the way.
Yeah.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
Which I feel like will come into context when we talk about the queerness of this movie as well. But we're very excited to have you on. Welcome. So I guess right off the bat, just to ask you, what's your like relationship with both? Do you love the music of Elton and Queen, or like how do you like, yeah, I feel like coming into movies like sometimes, but like for these two specifically, I feel like if you like the music, it might have like a little bit of a hand of which way you lean.
Just a little bit.
Just a smidge, but
I'm older than both of you, and so this was music I grew up on in the 70s and then more in the 80s too with Elton John. So both Queen and Elton John were in my sphere all the time. And I loved both, although it's funny because as a teenager in the 80s, you know, you always look to music that came before or like even a generation before. So like one of my group of friends really loved like this era of music. So late 70s and early 80s, just before we became teenagers, kind of was really popular for us to look back on. And I mean, I'd always loved Elton John and his trajectory.
Yes.
Flying into the sky.
Yeah. This is going to be a totally weird, seemingly non sequitur, but when I was young, outside of listening to Elton John, I didn't really know anything about him because I was really young. But my dad was a horrible person and like really xenophobic and homophobic and racist and all of these things. So he would constantly, every time he heard Elton John, he would always regurgitate the, I don't know if you guys are aware of the old rumor between him and Rod Stewart.
No.
Okay, so.
Oh my goodness.
Here we go.
The story goes, whatever validity to it that there is, was that Rod Stewart and Elton John had hooked up, and Elton John had to go to the hospital to have his stomach pumped from everything he had ingested from Rod Stewart.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And my dad would repeat that story all the time. So it was, I had this like love of music of Elton John. And then this was my concept or understanding of him. It was so bizarre. And obviously it took, you know, me being an adult to
to unpack that, I feel like.
Yeah, and to understand, you know, fact and fiction and all right. that crap.
Oh yeah, my God. Because that's like physically impossible for starters.
It's ridiculous, as I found out later in life.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, what? I mean, if anything, I feel like that was something that would be in Bohemian Rhapsody where they're like, Freddie, look, we got to take you to the hospital. It seems that you've been having sex with too many men and that we just have to clean you out. It's like,
excuse me? Oh sorry? My God. That's literally. Oh,
that's insane. God. I'm so sorry.
It was crazy. It was crazy.
That oh is God. Like sort of an interesting thing to have to come to terms with. And if there's one thing that both of these movies like absolutely hit on extremely hard, it's like the media presence in regards to like personal life. Obviously not a huge surprise to anyone, but just like how damaging that was and how like infectious it was and like shaping these people's lives, like especially in regards to sexuality. Yeah.
Yeah. And parental response to sexuality too.
Of course.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's super interesting that these films came out. I mean, granted, looking at like both like Queen producing Bohemian Rhapsody and Elton being a producer on Rocketman, I think like there you have to take that into context within the films and sort of like how that sort of, you know, evens out some of the rough edges. But I think it's interesting that both of these films happened when they did, because I feel like if they even happened like 10 years prior, some of the sexuality and the media portrayal would be so different.
I think we had to have like as much distance as we did from this happening to like be able to fully, like, even though they don't really fully reckon with it, but to be able to even include that in the first place, because you have to get far away from like the, oh right, this was bad, we don't do this anymore, we quote unquote don't do
well
this
one of the
anymore.
Films doesn't really do that well, but yeah.
Yeah, I know, right? But like, you know, you need to have that space in order to even like include that on screen, because like it's about Hollywood and it's about these things that actually happened. Like, no one is gonna wanna throw their journalist friends from 5 years ago under the bus.
When you say Hollywood, I just think of the one shot in Rocketman, though. It's every time when they go to LA, but it's when they're like, we're going to Hollywood, and then it's like a shot of Hollywood. It's like hilarious. I mean, they do it with Bohemian Rhapsody, though, with the best thing, where it's Midwest USA, and they tell you that we're
with all of the
red, white, and blue.
The city, no, like the city's going by.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's so weirdly dated.
Yes. Should we just talk? I feel like because there's so much to cover. Yes. I don't even know how. I guess like the first thing, it's just like bio. Like, I feel like because these are both music biopics and they're coming so far after like Walk the Line and then even Walk Hard, which is just essentially functioned as like the breakdown of the music biopic. Mm-hmm. And they both, Rocketman does it in a better way by, I think, when it has Rocketman, I think just at its core works better when it functions on such a fantastical level. And it's like leaning into the fantasy of like Elton's world, both in like the music sequences and everything. Cause I feel like when you have the framework of sort of, you know, the AA meeting, or I guess like him going into like recovery,
the AA meeting, right?
It like kind of takes you a little bit out of it. Whereas Bohemian Rhapsody is just a literal, like by the books, music, like biopic about like, this is how the band formed. And
it's so straight.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing, because like the music for both of these movies is just so incredible. And like, you want to show it off as much as possible. And I feel like Rocketman does a much better job showing it off like as pieces of music and performance. Whereas Bohemian Rhapsody is like, we all know that people like Queen. Here we go. Like, here's some Queen for you. And we'll set it to a nice little montage. Like, I feel like there's not a lot of engagement between the actual on-screen, you know, images and the actual music that's happening, which is hilarious because it won Best Editing.
What editing?
What? I mean, all there's of the so editing. Much editing.
Actually, like,
all of the editing.
Right, it is edited. That's true.
It's most editing, for
I mean,
sure.
There's that. There was the thing on Twitter going back with the scene where they sit down with Aidan Gillen, and it's like, yes, It's like that is insane editing. It is
43 cuts in 1 minute or something like that.
The whole movie. It's insane.
But it's so weird because it doesn't even feel like frenetic editing. We talked about The Departed a long time ago and how like the editing in that is very intentional and meant to like invoke the sense of Bohemian Rhapsody just feels like they were like, more edits. We need more edits.
We have to see everybody. Right. You want to see Brian May, don't you? You want to know what he was feeling when they were signing this contract. It's like,
but
no,
the scene is scenes like that where all that they're just sitting around a table are still like going at a pretty like average plotting pace. So you're like, I don't understand why I'm only seeing people's faces for half a second. Right. And I don't know.
Oh my God. Eric is now actually Elton sitting with his wings.
Eric cycling through Zoom backgrounds. That's incredible. And they're all fabulous.
How do you want to approach this?
Okay, so we were talking about biopics. So let's talk about like the nature of a biopic and like how these biopics came to be. And then Bohemian Rhapsody, I feel like it's important to talk about, like we'll cover the bases on that first because it came first.
Yes.
And then we can go into Rocket Man.
So go bad to good.
Yeah.
I think that's smart. How Rocketman improves upon
Bohemian Rhapsody, but how Bohemian Rhapsody ended up getting all the glory. But for starters,
$905 million.
That's so
$905 million.
Do you remember the Twitter stands? Eric, you must remember the Twitter stands.
Oh yeah. No, I got into fights with people. It was insane. It was like, okay, cool. So you really just wanted a greatest hits Queen album. You could have just fucking bought that.
Exactly. Right. And it's like all these 13-year-olds are like, thanks, Maddie saw Bo Rap times 48 or whatever. Like,
Eric, you were one of our finest soldiers on the front lines, really just putting down your life.
It was weirdly like a Titanic thing for people, which was...
Right.
It was genuinely super surprising. And regardless of my feelings about the movie, it was fascinating as a phenomenon. Because I don't think anybody, even the studio, could have predicted where it was going to go financially. Because $52 million is a really conservative price for a movie, even a biopic.
Oh my God, yeah.
Somebody in a group that's super popular. It's still risky. You don't know.
Yeah.
It was fascinating to watch, but also at the same time, it was like, yeah, movies are really lowest common denominator sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And not, I mean, in this case, I don't think it was like particularly a taste issue from the collective that watched it. Because it, like I said, it was mostly like teenagers, but like never underestimate the buying power of teenage girls. Like girls have single-handedly dragged so many movies that you're like, why on earth did this make nearly $1 billion worldwide?
But it's like, if you look, if we're just going to, just on like a pure like looking at people and how beautiful they are sort of a thing, just like in this thing, if you have like an interest into people,
yeah,
I feel like Rocket Man is a better looking movie, just the people acting in it
like, has hotter people,
right?
Yes.
Like everyone's far hotter in Rocket Man than in Bohemian Rhapsody. Like everyone in Bohemian Rhapsody looks like they're like a CGI cutout of someone somehow.
What's interesting to me too is that I feel like the relationships, which a lot I think is like what drove a lot of literally like the Bohemian Rhapsody fandom, which is hilarious to say as a sentence, but a lot of what drove them was like the relationships and like, oh, we love Freddie so much and his struggle. And it's like, I think that like the Rocket Man struggle and relationships, particularly between like Elton and John, are so much more interesting.
Oh my God, yeah.
But I mean, is it just a matter of Bohemian Rhapsody got there a year earlier?
I feel like it had to be because it took so much thunder away from Rocket Man when it came out. Just the amount of money in between, just Point Blank. And I think I remember sitting in the theater and just seeing the Rocket Man trailer and sort of getting the same energy of just, oh no, here we go again, thinking that it was just going to be another Bohemian Rhapsody. And I feel like just people were probably afraid of that and like didn't ultimately end up seeing it, when it is to its core a far different,
it's
not
so different.
Far different, but it is different no matter what.
It's so weird because the plot beats are almost exactly the same, but the energy is like very different.
Yeah.
Eric, you track this stuff really closely. Do you think that it's just a matter of like it was a race to the finish line, or do you think it would have followed the same trajectory had like the release dates been swapped?
I think it would have been like fun to have them be released much closer together, like a Deep Impact Armageddon kind of thing. Mm. But the real big factor here was the difference between Bohemian Rhapsody being PG-13 and Rocketman being rated R. And the willingness for Paramount to let Rocketman be R and be a much deeper, more sexualized film than Bohemian Rhapsody was.
Yeah.
And even though, too, both films were backed by the people that were there, you know, one exists with the main person being dead and having no voice or say in it. And throughout the entire movie, Brian May and Queen are the heroes and Freddie Mercury is the villain. There is no parsing it any other way than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in Rocket Man, Elton John, producing with his husband, allows the ugly and the beautiful to exist because they both did exist.
Right.
And it just kind of does a better job. So I think while still being really glossy and having all of the accoutrement of a musical biopic or a music biopic.
Yes.
I think it was just the difference. People wanted a greatest hits album. And I have tons of friends, of close friends that, you know, loved the movie. And they just told me, oh my God, I loved it so much. What did you think? And I'm just like, well, and every time, like, I don't like something that they really love, I get that kind of side eye of like, oh, well, you know, you're a critic. So
yes.
I'm not invalidating your love for it because I totally understand why it made $900 million. I'm just saying that I don't like it because of this.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the rating is one of the biggest reasons for the difference in audiences.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I totally agree. I think that's a great assessment. And it's very interesting to look at the difference in rating because, like, when you really get down to brass tacks, the only difference is that, like, in Rocket Man, they can say fuck. Like, there's not really any non-PG-13 nudity or sexuality.
There's one sex scene.
But, like, it's not like you see anything.
Right, right.
There's, like, butts and there's writing and side shots and all of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Which the way the MPA is. And how they treat straight sex versus any other type of sex.
Exactly.
Or anyway.
Yes.
Right.
It already would have been.
Which is listed
as sexuality.
Interesting to think about when you're like, yeah, but I mean, if those were straight people, that sex scene would be totally admissible in a PG-13 movie, no problem.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Absolutely.
You could even show boobs.
Yes. Right.
Literally. Ugh, it's... gets you mad because then
it pisses me off.
Because then you just think about it's just really, I think it boils down to, I mean, we're the queer quadrant and I feel like a lot of like our conversations boil down to this. And I think one of the things that is so frustrating is about the queer portrayal of these two icons, because no matter what community you're coming from, just broad stroke LGBTQ+, like these are two icons of the queer community. And like specifically like Elton for like the gay community or Freddie for the bi community. Mm. And to have... mm-hmm. sort of like this portrayal on screen is such an exciting thing, but then looking at Bohemian Rhapsody and it just being such blatant erasure of his sexuality and having his queerness be taken away from him just from the beginning, and it's sort of everything is thrust upon him. Freddie never has like a sense of agency, and it like Paul grabs him in the beginning and that is him being like, oh, you're gay, or literally there's the point where Mary is just like, Freddie, you're gay, and it's like, no, like, he wasn't just gay.
I'm
and, like,
need
to enforce
do.
That on him is so infuriating, where Rocketman at least lets him sort of, like, come to terms with his sexuality in a much greater way. And, I mean, Taron is, like, phenomenal in the movie, and we'll get to Jamie Bell, because I think he steals the show in the movie, but...
he's the best.
Okay. Jamie...
You're jumping topic to topic.
Okay, I know. I'm reining us back to where I was. But yeah, I guess at the end of the day, in terms of queerness, it's just like it's so infuriating seeing sort of like how the two get portrayed, and then for Bohemian Rhapsody to be so much more popular, and for people to sort of be like, right, that's like what Freddie was like, and just it's to view it in black and white, and so many people walk away from this movie. If you just read online, I was like scrolling through different Reddit threads at the time, and a lot of people were just calling Freddie gay and all these different things, and just completely erasing so much of his sexual orientation and his background. It's just infuriating, and just the way it pictures queer people is just through such a homophobic lens. It's just like all queer people within Bohemian Rhapsody are like evil and over sexualized beings, and it's just like this consistent trope that we've seen throughout time where queer people are only focused on sex and never about just like them being people.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot to unpack there. I'm gonna need to do like 10 minutes alone on the "I think I'm bisexual, you're gay, Freddy" exchange,
right?
Which, like, I don't think I've ever been as angry in a theater as I was at that moment. Obviously, that is like something very personal to both of us. I just realized that we never introduced ourselves, by the way.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson.
Yeah, okay. So that was like the worst scene ever. Because I remember sitting in the theater and being like, wow, he just said he's bisexual. That's insane. And then like before I could even process it, to have Mary cut him off and be like, "Freddie, you're gay." And then to never have that dynamic or dichotomy or anything in that realm be brought up again over the course of the movie, and like only showing him having so much gay sex that he can't even handle it throughout the rest of his life, and like really pushing Mary into this like strictly companion role without any sort of like non-platonic affection is just a very confusing decision.
Yeah, well, it's just so heteronormative. It's just like such a straight person's view of queerness.
Yes.
And just like, which is, it's just, I mean, you can go back to the Bryan Singer of it all, which is, I think, it's, I don't want to discuss it, but
we
have to, but it's, he is such a toxic person within the queer community. And I think no matter what, if you look at all of his movies, there is a through line of queerness. We've talked about like the X-Men and stuff like that, but a lot of his portrayal of queerness is from a lens that he doesn't like it. Like, he never portrays queer people in a necessarily positive manner. He views it sort of as like a sin and this bad
deviancy.
Thing that like, exactly, this literally,
yes,
that like,
my god,
the
Adam Lambert at the truck stop thing,
oh my god,
absolutely horrible,
a mess,
horrifying.
Yeah And I mean, I don't know if you could tell that he's attracted to men by the giant men sign that they zoom in on after Adam Lambert walks to the bathroom, you know.
I
really
think
subtle.
One of the things that this does is a huge conversation, umbrella conversation over the last few years has thankfully been, you know, who gets to tell the stories that we tell, and that is improving a great deal from what it used to be. But then something like Bohemian Rhapsody is a pretty prime example of, you know, not every queer person is the right person to tell that story. They might have the cachet to do it. They might have the black book that can expose a whole lot of people if they don't get what they want, but it doesn't mean that they're the right person for it. And you're absolutely right that Bryan Singer films queerness through a lens of self-hatred that is it's astonishing in its obviousness.
Yes. In like what, and of course it's easy now to go back and look and be like, oh right, this makes far too much sense, and just how much he hates it. And yeah, obviously Bryan Singer sole directing credit on Bohemian Rhapsody despite having been fired like two-thirds of the way through production.
And you do wonder what scenes Dexter did versus didn't do, because then you watch Rocket Man, and while Dexter, correct me if I'm wrong, is not queer, right?
I mean, he is married to a woman, and okay, that is all that I was
right
able to find.
But
so
he at least handles queerness in Rocket Man with a more deft hand than obviously Brian does.
It's much more tender, and it's like right, feels like an actual relationship, which I think is very interesting looking at Bohemian Rhapsody, how like the sex of it all, like you were saying, Jordan, the gay sex is like this crazy deviant, like super harmful, super wild thing, and like the only tender interactions that he has with Jim Hutton are so like horribly sterilized.
Yes.
And so like, I mean, I think that both of the actors are great, but there's not like a ton of, I would say, directing chemistry there, if that makes sense.
Well, for him and Jim to have like such a healthy relationship towards the end of his life, and for him to sort of be, you know, that like, not like life partner or whatever, but the person that he ends up spending the rest of his life with before he dies, and for him to have like essentially what, 2-3 scenes, and he sort of stands there at the side in Live Aid and is just like, that's my Freddy. Like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, it's so weird. And then it's like, you compare and contrast that with Rocket Man, which even though John Reed ends up like being a piece of shit, their early like love scenes are so authentic. And you're like, oh, I get why he would fall in love with this guy.
For sure.
I mean, same with Paul in Bohemian Rhapsody, who is just like the carbon copy of the John Reed character, even though John Reed is also in Bohemian Rhapsody. It's so
I know, I love
it's
the
so crazy
pollination.
Yeah. I also like that in Bohemian Rhapsody, they were like, yeah, Aidan Gillen, you know, respected British theater actor, like a little austere, a little buttoned up, like good manager. And then for Rocketman, they were like, Richard Madden, though. Sexy young bitch. Let's
go. I mean, he got upgraded. Let's be real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But like it's with Paul, who basically fills the like toxic professional / personal man role in Bohemian Rhapsody. Like he and Freddie also, like there's nothing there. So it's so weird that they get together, because from the beginning, you're like, this man is, like you said, Eric, extremely lecherous, extremely, like, feels like he's taking advantage of Freddie, even though Freddie is clearly, like, attracted to men. But it feels so, like, domineering in this really, like, gross way where you're like, it feels like Freddie's being duped by the gay community as a whole, instead of falling for someone who's bad for him.
And that's part and parcel of how Bohemian Rhapsody is treated from beginning to end. It's fan service and very little more than that, but it's also it's fan service for hetero cis normative people. Yes. And that's it. There is no room for a queer audience in this movie at all, despite being about one of the biggest queer icons of all time. It's an afterthought. And all of the attention goes to everything else. And it's why all of this, the relationship and sexuality stuff, is either given a short shrift or awkwardly inserted or treated as just ugly, dangerous, and awful. And, you know, you have people, whether they are 13-year-old girls or whether they are 50-year-old fans of Queen, that are seeing that, and maybe they have never thought about Freddie Mercury's sexuality, which they might not have. They just like, I just like the music. And that's a big part of a fan base for a movie like this. I just like the music. Mm-hmm. So all of that stuff and the introduction of that stuff, the way it's presented is how those people are going to see and regard that maybe for the first time. And then that's their takeaway. And that is so gross.
To the tune of $900 million worldwide. Like, that is so much more exposure than, like, the biggest blockbusters that we see. And, like, that, I feel like, is why Bohemian Rhapsody stings a little bit extra. Because you're, like, not only, like, is it a bad portrayal, but this is the portrayal that, essentially, like, the world sees and, like, will remember this as. I'm always struck by there are the, like, I guess the like downward spiral sequence in both Bohemian Rhapsody with Another One Bites the Dust and Rocket Man with Benny and the Jets, like it's essentially the same sequence.
But the Benny and the Jets one
is so much better.
So good.
Yeah. And like in Bohemian Rhapsody, it's like framed as Paul dragging Freddie into like this dangerous, like dark underground world of gay clubs. You know, it's very like leathered up and stuff like
right,
that.
That's also, it's like such a straight portrayal of like
the
queer
gay community
spaces. It's like, what are like, where do like the gay people go, and like what's like scary and edgy there? But it's
like I watched Cruising once. Here we
yes.
go.
Literally, yeah, they like drive through WeHo and they're like, no, this is like evil.
How much leather can we pack into one room before people get the picture? And it's like, it's all about like, it's directly like paralleling the gay community to a downward spiral, whereas that basically copy and paste sequence in Rocket Man is about like addiction and like losing it and about debauchery. And I actually like that it's very like not gay specific. There's like that cool dreamy orgy like sequence.
Good.
It's so good. The visuals are nice.
Rockman rocks on it rewatch. It does. Yeah.
But like that whole sequence is very like, you know, there's men, there's women, there's like not a specific slant, and it is much more about the like losing your sense of humanity than it is about like going deep into the sexuality aspect of it. And like, look at that. That is not that big of a difference, but it totally changes how those sequences affect the characters and affect like their weaknesses and what's pulling them away. It hurts.
With Rocketman too, like off that, if you're thinking like in terms of like the coming out sequences and like Elton sort of coming to terms with his queerness, again, it is much more nuanced in terms of, like Elton is the one who sort of like comes to terms with the sexuality throughout the whole thing. And there is like the classic scene where like he goes to Bryce Dallas Howard and is like, "Mom, I'm gay." And she's like, "I knew, like, blah, blah, blah. I kind of hate you still. Like, don't talk, like, don't do that near me."
Way that scene turns from you think it's going to be an embrace and then it's not. Oh my God.
It's gutting. And like, Bryce, look, I don't know if her wig and her fits are doing it all for her in this movie, but that is the best scene that she's in the movie.
She's pretty good. She's pretty good,
but she at least
she's good when she's not like really going over the top with the accent.
Yes.
She's like, "Reggie, come in the house, Reggie." I'm just like, calm yourself.
It's gonna be okay. Yes.
It's like it sounds
we know
like
you're
Annie.
Not British.
Yeah. When he goes to Bryce, it at least feels much more like an experience within the queer community. Like I had the same hesitation coming out to my parents, and while it didn't necessarily go that way, there are so many other people who have had that experience coming out with their parents. Like I've had friends where it's like that, where like it's not necessarily going well and it feels like it's done in just such a much more tender manner, and like you care about him so much more. And while, as you were saying, like the relationship with Richard Madden isn't healthy and it is ultimately very toxic, you understand that the toxicity comes from Richard Madden and
from him as a person,
stemming that he is like a very egocentric terrible person versus it being like his queerness is why he is evil.
Yes.
Which is so integral to like the two stories and like the difference. And because ultimately neither of these movies are about the men and their sexuality. This is not like Brokeback Mountain or like just a movie that's just inherently about like queerness, but with two queer characters as the lead, it is such an integral part of who they are,
right,
that it has to be like sort of talked about in the same way.
It's more so with Rocketman, because the journey for Elton John in his real life to get to bisexuality as a way to kind of ease into what was his actual sexuality, that's a real journey for him. And one of the things I really love also about Rocketman is that it is about two things. It is about addiction. It is about sexuality. It's about them separately and then where they do intersect. And it's just done better and more honestly. And again, this is when, you know, the person behind it has the agency for it. Whereas in Bohemian Rhapsody, the person behind it has none at all and never did.
Yeah. And to allow, like, in Bohemian Rhapsody for Queen, the other members of Queen, to function as, like, something that's going to pull Freddie out of his spiral, i.e. sexuality, is crazy. But they're like, well, Paul is the root of all of these issues. And, like, he's the root of all of it because he's gay. I mean, I don't think it helps that they literally don't give Paul any character besides him being, like, the biggest dick to ever walk the earth. He's just sucks. He's so terrible. And he, like, doesn't seem to contribute anything. And Queen is always like, why the fuck are you here? We knew you were shit from the beginning. And so, of course, you as an audience member are like, yeah, same. That dichotomy, I feel like, just is truly harmful. I don't think that it was like necessarily completely intentional for it to come off that way, but that is the way it comes off. Like you said earlier, Eric, it's difficult to read Bohemian Rhapsody any other way than the other members of Queen are the heroes and Freddie is the villain and they have to save Freddie from himself.
It's so bad, especially, I mean, as it gets to the end and he has to like apologize to everybody and it's just,
yeah,
it just gets worse and worse.
It does.
Yeah, no, the fact that they make it, we've talked about this before, but where the queer character has to go and apologize for their queerness to their straight friends is like the most infuriating trope when they're, especially even if they're not the villain or whatever, but where they have to be like, I'm sorry that like I was off doing this like queer thing. I'm back now with my straight friends. Don't worry. Like things are okay now. And it's like, you don't need to apologize for being who you are. Like you should be proud of like your queerness. And at the end of the day, the fact that it ends with Elton sort of embracing the fantasy and him like turning out all right is great. And then in Live, like Bohemian Rhapsody ends with Live Aid and it's like, well, he's going to die and we don't deal with the consequences of it. And that's it. Then Freddie died of AIDS. Cool. Bye.
Like, yeah.
What the fuck?
I think the Bohemian Rhapsody tries poorly to split the difference by being like, well, Freddie has to apologize for trying to break the band apart, essentially. And then when he reveals that he has AIDS at a key moment before Live Aid.
Which is such, like, the timeline and the misinformation in Bohemian Rhapsody. Oh,
yeah.
Keep going. But sorry, yeah.
Here's the thing, though, because there isn't a biopic in existence that does not manipulate timelines and stuff to expedite information, especially if it's taking place over a longer period of time. And Rocketman does that, too, constantly, nonstop. It uses, you know, the bitch is back, you know, when he's a kid. It uses his I'm still standing to represent, you know, recovery at a different time. It does that all over the place. And it does it more successfully. And I think it does it more successfully because it is actually a musical as well.
Yes, yes.
And that allows you that suspension of disbelief so that you are using the songs as a soundtrack for life,
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
not simply as here's the next song and here's the
when
next
they came
song,
out.
The next song.
Yes.
But yeah, what Bohemian Rhapsody does, oh my God, especially in that last 15 minutes, is so mind-blowingly bad. And again, if you don't know that as a person who just likes the music, you're just like, oh, this is so cool. Everything's wrapped up and this is awesome. And now we can just get to Live Aid.
Right.
Yep.
And it's like, imagine having all of your life, all these bows just perfectly happen on the same day. You're just able to get the new guy. You're able to clean up and everything's okay with your friends. You're able to give the biggest performance of your life and all is well.
Mm-hmm. You really hit the nail on the head, Eric, with like every biopic does this, but because Bohemian Rhapsody wants to take itself like so much mm-hmm. as fact, as like this is a completely accurate portrayal of what went down. Like there's no sense of like in Rocketman, no sense of that like greater cinematic basically like squishing.
Well, like Rocketman's operating
that
it
comes off very differently. Yeah.
It's operating on like Mamma Mia terms because like not like a bit like genuinely like I will die for Mamma Mia, but like it's a jukebox musical about Elton John versus being like a music it's like also functioning as a biopic, but like I never once thought about, as you were saying, like the songs aren't coming out when his like life's in order, et cetera. But like the songs function specifically like to focus in on his emotions. And the whole point, as we've discussed so many times before, is like musicals operate like the music takes place when you have like you can't find the words or the things to say. The songs are there to heighten your emotions and explain what's going on to the audience. And Rocketman does that in such a successful way because it is just like this is the song that best represents what he was going through versus Bohemian Rhapsody is so, as you were saying, by the numbers, like this came out, then this came out, then this came out.
And then this was their single.
Which is why it works so much better.
Yeah. And I don't think Bohemian Rhapsody, had they made that decision as well, would have been as successful.
I agree. People like things that are uncomplicated. It's just like it's a movie. It's a story. You can just sit back and watch it unfold. I'm not a huge fan of the first 30 minutes of Rocketman, the like family stuff.
The little kid is the worst.
He's not the worst. He's pretty cute.
When are you going to hug me?
It's
a little slutty.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot on the nose. And yeah.
But that... Yeah, that I feel like it's more difficult for an audience to be like, oh, Jesus, the family is singing. nobody loves this kid. This is like a lot to take in right now. Whereas obviously Bohemian Rhapsody kicks it right off with like, okay, let's get some music. Let's get some bands. Here we go.
It's such a mess in the beginning. There's like, they're like, do you like Queen songs? Here's every single Queen song all at once. Yeah. And like, oh my God, stop.
And my same friends that liked Bohemian Rhapsody, they went into Rocketman not knowing it was a musical. And
oh,
they
same.
Didn't, and they didn't like it because of that. They're like, wait, they started singing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because it's.
Yeah. Did you read anything about this before you watched it?
Mm-hmm. It's like you said, they just. A greatest hits album put to screen, Rocket Man is not. It's an actual, like, reckoning with the music, like Jordan said. But yeah, I also did not know it was a musical when I went in. Clearly, oh. I didn't do my research.
Interesting.
I mean, look, I happen to love musicals. So they started singing, and I was like, oh shit. It's like an actual musical. Let's go. But I think it is a very different experience, especially, you know, musicals are, I would say, a niche, except for maybe Mamma Mia, which everyone loves because it's the best. But like, you know, if I were a local person who went to see Bohemian Rhapsody.
Maybe if you lived in Midwest USA.
Yes,
a
in
local
Midwest.
Person,
and I went into Bohemian Rhapsody and I was like, okay, great. You know, it was a movie about music. And then I went into Rocket Man and they actively started singing. I was like, well, I didn't sign up for no musical bullshit. Like, this is a completely different type of movie. I'm not interested in this.
Yeah.
I think that as you were, that all totally also comes back to like when these films came out and their whole like awards approach and everything, because Bohemian Rhapsody coming first sets in the recent memory, like, oh, this is what a movie about like a very popular queer, you know, singer would be about, versus like if Rocket Man came out first and we didn't have the imprint of Bohemian Rhapsody, I'm sure that it might have been taken a little differently or better, potentially.
It just wouldn't have had to overcome the massive juggernaut that was Bohemian Rhapsody to like even get any sort of awards attention.
Yeah, and they were only 6 months apart. It was a really risky decision on Paramount's part to release Rocket Man in May as like a summer tentpole kind of movie, because Bohemian Rhapsody had just come out in November and, you know, just won Oscars. So the shadow wasn't just looming. It was completely engulfing them.
Yeah. And I mean, we all saw what happened. It's so crazy. We all watched these back to back. I watched them on like two nights, and it's crazy to look at the difference in quality and to think about, really, if all was fair in the world, like what should have gotten what. Just
it's really upsetting.
If you even look at like a technical level, yes. I think Rocket Man is much better technically.
The crocodile rock sequence when they're all going la and they're all floating, it's so cool. It's great.
It's my favorite sequence in the whole movie.
Same.
Because even though the whole thing is a musical, that takes it to that magical realism level. So that you're recreating the feeling of being at a concert and the euphoria of it. And it's one of the great things that a musical can do is totally step outside of reality and be about feeling and emotion completely. And oh my God, that moment is everything.
It's transcendent.
Because everyone freaks out. Jamie Bell's going bananas on like the top floor, grabbing everyone around him. Like, are you seeing what I'm seeing? I'm on my couch looking at my cat saying, are you seeing what I'm seeing? You know, that was like, I have never, like, it was so nice to feel a high like that, because I mean, we love musicals on this podcast.
Yes, we
and
do.
When a musical is able to capture such joy and feeling and emotion, it's just such a specific high that you'll never be able to get. And with Bohemian Rhapsody, I don't know if there's even a sequence that brings me at. Oh my God!
Eric just changed his background to Taron Egerton kissing Jamie Bell in costume, and it's the cutest photo I've ever
That's
seen.
That's beautiful.
Look at them.
Jamie Bell.
Their relationship is so great. I will just yes, I totally agree with you on the musical thing. But like, I'm not gonna pretend that I wasn't hyped at the Bohemian Rhapsody sequences. That music is just so good. I'm not immune to good Queen songs. Like, I'm not immune to recreating, and I'm not talking about Live Aid, but I'm not immune to like recreating this concert atmosphere. Yeah. Like, it's, you still get hyped, but Whereas I feel like the music is doing all of the heavy lifting. In Rocket Man, there's actually like a very clear vision to incorporate the music with whatever is going on. And like we've said, structuring those sequences very specifically with what song is best for that moment.
It's so funny thinking about everything that happens right before the Live Aid sequence and then how the introduction of Elton John going out in the baseball outfit to that big concert, right from, you know, the stretcher, boom, 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 and then walking in. And how it's why a musical works better for this kind of thing, because you don't have this like pedantic sequence, Live Aid. You have the feeling and the emotion of it going into the, it lets
you have complicated emotions about that Dodger, you know, LA Dodger sequence, which like he absolutely rocks, but you're coming in with the knowledge that like he feels conflicted about this. Whereas with Bohemian Rhapsody, they tie the AIDS storyline up into a nice little bow. And then they're like, okay, great. He's going to give like the performance of his life. And that's the end. Like you feel the sort of like pity sympathy that you really don't want to feel. And it's like, I don't know. It doesn't allow you to engage with the character on the level that you should be engaging
at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the cats are doing the heavy lifting in Bohemian Rhapsody, if
the
anything.
The cutest cats. They are so cute. They're really fluffy.
Right.
I love them.
But like when he's singing to them, I'm like, at least the cat's reaction is more believable than anything else in this
Everyone's
movie.
Everyone's a critic.
Which is an interesting, we have something we haven't talked about yet, and that is that Taron Egerton sang.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And Rami Malek is not, which we haven't even mentioned his name.
Wait, that's wild.
Let's talk
it's really
performances.
Weird.
Let's talk performances.
Teeth the movie is my pitch, because who did the prosthetics on this?
A lot of teeth business.
Why was it not? We were talking off mic about this before, but Sacha Baron Cohen was originally attached.
Yeah.
Which is the best version of this movie, because he is such a good performer and is such a good singer. I mean, I will stand on my stump and yell about how good he is in Les Mis any day of the week. If you just look at it like, I feel like him and Finch are doing a movie, or him and Tom Hooper, whoever he was attaching, that feels so much more like an interesting Freddie Mercury biopic than Rami Malek trying to understand how to be a human in this movie.
It would have never happened, though, because allegedly, right, Sacha Baron Cohen wanted a gritty R-rated tell-all, quote-unquote.
That's the whole reason that fell out.
Which is what the movie should be.
Yeah.
But, of course, like, with Queen involved, that was never going to happen. And obviously, if you look at Rocket Man, like, it's not exactly a gritty tell-all. Like, it's definitely pretty soft on a lot of stuff, but it just gets so much more right than Bohemian Rhapsody on such a staggering level that putting them side by side is like kind of mind-boggling. But Rami Malek apparently like didn't really know anything about Freddie Mercury before taking this role, which is
shocking.
Interesting. I will say I do applaud them for not casting some random white British guy.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
Cast person of color. That is nice. We'll just shout that out.
I think there is definitely something to that. Yeah. Some very minor applause given to at least leaning in that direction.
The bar is on the floor, but yes.
It really, really is.
Yes, but like following Sacha Baron Cohen departing from the movie due to creative differences, Ben Whishaw was like briefly in talks, which I mean, like the guy can
Paddington
sing.
Himself.
He's gay IRL, that's exciting.
Yeah.
But
I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't think it would have been a good fit.
Like, Rami is just such a, I feel like we've talked about, maybe we haven't on mic, but it's just, his energy is so specific that he brings like weird hacker energy, which is why Mr. Robot is good, because he's like a weird guy who like would wear a hoodie. Like, I don't see Rob, or like even the upcoming No Time to Die, will we ever have time to die? I don't know.
We will
but
never.
He at least like, that's the sort of role that he feels best fit for, where he's just a very weird guy doing weird things. Like Bohemian Rhapsody, he's just trying so hard in this movie, and it never ever connects. It's so hard to believe anything coming out of his mouth is sincere, because it just feels so behind all this makeup and behind everything. Like, you can never get to the emotionality of it. And the fact that he won Best Actor is so mind-blowing rewatching this movie. How?
I don't think it's that mind-blowing, but that yes. And Eric is nodding in agreement.
What do you think? Yeah, as the awards
specialist. The awards expert. Yeah.
I have so much egg on my face about this, about the awards potential of the movie. But just going backwards a little bit, I think what Bohemian Rhapsody did, and then I don't know if you've seen The Little Things.
Oh, my God.
Talk about some big choices.
I think it exposed how limited Rami Malek is as an actor, which is as narrow as you could possibly get. He's extremely limited as an actor, period. But I was pretty low on not just the film's chances, but on Rami Malek's chances back in, you know, it came out in November. And so like September or whatever, when I was doing my earlier stuff, I was just like, I just don't see it. He's got that Emmy. That's great. It's a biopic. That's great. But it was all about the money. If that was a movie that made $50 million, it wouldn't have won anything that it won. And he would have been probably wouldn't have been even nominated. I think it has like a 49 score on Metacritic. So he's the best actor winner with the lowest scoring film of all time.
It's crazy.
And this is about money. This is about money more than anything else.
Do you think that Bohemian Rhapsody, tying this back to like when The Dark Knight, like the 2008, when they sort of then expand everything, do you think
to
that,
like the 10 right picture, exactly,
to try to really incorporate
slate
more of like trying to get more of America invested in the Oscars, because this got a Best Picture nod? Do you feel like that is just specifically because they were trying to keep, like, because so many people, like, that it was basically just essentially a cash grab to then get people to watch the show as like a pitch?
Yeah, that's the reason why they wanted to do the popular film Oscar, which thankfully had a very short life and a very quick death.
I blocked that out of my memory.
You literally just brought up trauma that I had suppressed.
I totally forgot. And oh my God, the fucking nerve of them to do it the year that Black Panther was potentially in the Best Picture conversation. Oh my God.
That was the crazy thing about it is that weird, I mean, he was such a horrible president too. Was, I don't want the Oscars to be the, you know, Spirit Awards. I'm like, fuck you. But he tries to make this happen as like his last thing as president. And then look what happens. The box office of the Best Picture nominees is through the roof. It's huge. It's fantastic. And it was the next year too. It's just like, no, when you do have more open spots, you do get a broader perspective of the films of the year.
Yeah.
Best, maybe not necessarily, but you do get a broader perspective and instead of just five.
And studios are starting to have that kind of like chokehold on the Oscars again. I mean, I always think about like A Star Is Born, how people were like, well, you know, A Star Is Born, it's this risky film, and it's like that film made so much money. Five it was wonders. So popular. It was like this huge studio piece, like starring all these big actors, and then of course it was nominated for 10 Oscars or however many it was. Like, it's not, there's not the dichotomy that the Oscars seem to think that there is between popular films and films that are nominated for Oscars.
And this, if we're just like, the Oscars in general should just lean into what they are, which is like, at the end of the day, they're an awards show, and like, people are there for the awards and for the fun of it. Like, be 4 hours, be long, like, be what you have to be, like, get all the songs and like whatever it may be, but like, stop trying to like pander.
It's
and like
never gonna be
the
Super Bowl.
It's not it's not what it is. Like, just add a Best Stunts Performance category and we'll be done. That's great. That's all we need.
Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, really.
I know.
Were you shocked, since we're just on awards, with Rocketman, that Taron didn't get, because he won the Globe, like, so were you expecting that he would be getting an Oscar nom?
I need to look back at my predictions, because I think I might have had him in, because it was really heartbreaking. He got everything. He won the Globe. He was nominated for SAG and BAFTA. He had everything going in. But at the same time, almost every single year, somebody goes in with everything and then misses out. But I think if my memory serves correctly, he is the first person to have won the Globe and had all of the precursors and not get in.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And it's sad. It's heartbreaking. I felt really bad for him because, I mean, he was really kind of into it. He was really into the whole circuit.
Oh, totally.
And you know, he was, you know, one of the people up at 5:30 in the morning waiting for that announcement. I just feel really bad for him.
And
it hurts because he's so good. And he's so
singing.
Good.
He sings, which I, as we've talked about before, but like the fact that he is actually the one on the tracks doing the singing.
The voice of an angel.
Amazing. And the fact that he has a good voice too. Like, it's not bad. It's great.
That's another whole component in the comparison of the two where, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody is just a Queen track playing versus Rocket Man, which he doesn't sound exactly like Elton John. He doesn't look that much like Elton John. He's much stockier and thicker. Elton John is pretty slender and is had like an oval head, and Edgerton is just a thicker guy.
He got that insane jawline. Yeah.
His shoulders are huge.
God, I love him.
All of them, his thighs. I'm gonna bring that picture up in a minute.
Oh, great. I've been waiting.
Yeah. So I think there was, again, with audiences, there was sort of a break in the illusion enough to make them be like, well, it's not really Elton John.
Which is crazy when you think about, like, the energy that him versus Rami are exuding and, like, how much more that means to the actual character that he's playing. I feel like just that whole blip with the two actors was just a very, unfortunately, like, prime example of how the Academy looks at, like, performance versus public perception and, like, how often whatever's buzzy like sways their hand and like they're ignoring critics. There he is.
Beautiful.
Taron Egerton in all his short glory.
Look at those thighs.
Oh.
Incredible.
He's got a big bull head.
I just love
the glasses.
He's so good.
He's great.
But
it's like Robbie isn't even lip syncing that good. Like the lip syncing isn't good in Bohemian Rhapsody. You can tell that they're syncing things up.
The Live Aid sequence.
What is going? The CGI crowd is so, it looks like plastic fish swimming about, and there's so many white people in the crowd. I don't know if you guys.
I totally noticed that. I was
such
like, why?
An overwhelmingly white crowd,
yes.
Like to the point where it was like maybe that was what it was like when it was happening. I don't just like giving the film as much credit as it is, but even then, think about just modern audiences. Maybe throw a splash of any diversity in there whatsoever.
No, it was like a Bryan Singer pool party.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, no.
12 out of 10.
It's terrible. I also, this is, I hate the sort of like the final nail in the coffin on Live Aid is, you know, the inclusion of the fact that Queen apparently single-handedly raised all this money. There's this horrible framework of, you know, the Live Aid director being like, we have no money coming in. What's happening? This is a total failure. And then the minute Queen starts playing, they break $1 million or something. Like, right. I hated that more than anything else.
Like, why couldn't it have just been the performance?
What a concept. And I think that maybe, I'm not saying it's a good decision, but maybe it's the most creatively interesting decision that the film makes to like make the final 20-25 minutes just a straight up concert. I wish it was a
which
better
I think
concert.
Is fine. I mean, in the sense of in the spirit of fan service, because you know that's kind of what they're waiting for. They're just waiting for that to happen, and Singer knows that, and it's why all of the drama stuff and the emotion stuff is so rushed, because you just want to get to that end. But you know, that's also his collaboration with John Ottman, his editor, who's been his editor from the beginning. And like you said, Brooke, I don't know where the line is between Dexter Fletcher's, I think he really only had like 2 or 3 weeks.
Right. He said he had 2 weeks. And I read an interview that he was like, it was basically complete. I was mostly like tying the pieces together. Like all the major sequences were there. I was just going in and getting like the small stuff in between and like editing and cleaning up, basically.
Like he was,
it was like a patch job.
Yeah.
So I think for all the creative choices, we can give all of that credit to Bryan Singer.
Yeah. So, all of it gets heaped on him.
Yes.
Do you think with the editing, because I was remember reading this at the time, that it won the best editing Oscar just simply because sort of like a lifetime achievement slash sort of just recognition for being able to sort of patch the movie together because of the fact that it had
two different directors
and sort of like how mishmashed it was? Because if you just like, I mean, if we're just looking at it, like obviously it is not the best edited movie. It is just not a great edited movie at all. But is that like,
as we said, it's most editing.
I think there is a certain component to that. Yeah.
The other nominees that year are relatively weak, though, I would say, especially in the Academy Awards eyes. Like the other editing Oscars from that year are Black Klansman, The Favorite, Green Book, and Vice. Like,
so it should go to The Favorite, duh.
Yes, but
I think you're right. I think because Roma was not there.
Yeah.
Right.
Pretty big snub. Vice was not really a front runner, but it was pretty close to, it was really kind of front runner there because it was just such a large and expansive and also weirdly edited film.
Right.
The Oscars like flashy everything. They like flashy editing. They like flashy performances. Like, the more of something there is, I think the higher the chances are. Of course, every once in a while, the Oscars pull off something great. You know, it happens. That's the fun of award season. But for the most part, I think that being a little bit cynical about their picks often pays off prediction-wise.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Do
you remember the clip that they played for Rami Malek's like nomination, which
when he at the piano?
I don't. What was it?
It's literally a clip of him when he is basically composing Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's him lip syncing the "Sometimes I Wish I've Never Been Born at All."
Like, it's bad.
It's possibly the worst clip they could have chosen because, like, it's not. It's a particularly bad lip syncing throughout.
It is because he's just kind of like staring off, like into the like out the window or whatever. And it's just, oh my, as if this is the writing process. And it was, oh my God.
That's so messy.
Yeah, like it's a bad performance clip. It's a bad lip syncing clip. Nothing happens in it. And like, it's just considering how much conversation there had been around like, well, he's lip syncing and like no one sounds like Freddie Mercury, but he's not even doing a full performance. It's just deranged to me that they chose that clip instead of, I don't know, his AIDS monologue. Not that that's amazing, but at least that's like all Rami.
Even the Freddie or gay, just get his reaction shot from that.
Okay, how I just, this is kind of a non sequitur, but I really hate how they basically relegate Mary in Bohemian Rhapsody to being this girl who keeps falling in love with secretly gay men with that line that they throw in at the end, which is clearly supposed to be a one off joke about how her new boyfriend is probably gay.
Wait, I was probably so angry that I missed this. Oh, look at Terrence.
We have
singing.
Elton. Taron Alton.
Look at him.
That's how you do a creation of a song.
Look at him care about what he's singing. That is a beautiful thing. And that's the annoying thing is like,
No.
You go to your point.
Oh, no.
I actually genuinely want to know when did this happen? Because I literally missed this in the movie twice.
It's right before Live Aid when they're all sitting around in the trailer. Uh-huh. And I don't remember what her boyfriend's name is, but Freddie's like, what do we think of him? I think he's gay. And it's like, oh, haha, Freddy. Classic.
Oh, my God.
But, like, I don't, you just reduced your character, who's supposed to be the emotional core of this movie, the one that's pulling Freddy back from the edge,
to a bit
of a girl who keeps falling in love with gay men.
Oh, my God. I missed that twice. That's so funny. That's messy.
Ever.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's not talk about it anymore.
Great.
Let's talk about Taron Egerton.
Should we wrap up Bohemian Rhapsody? Like any
I mean, I'm sure we'll hit on it again when we wrap it up at the end. Yeah,
it's just such a mess. I mean, yeah, let's get into Rocket Man.
Let's talk about Taron Egerton.
The scene before Taron, there's just the one scene where the kid, when we're in middle school Taron, where it's not the young one who's like, when are you going to hug me? But it's like a little bit older.
Piano prodigy.
I adore the scene where he goes in and the woman's playing the piano and then he copies her and he stops because that's as far as she got. That is such a well-executed sequence. And it is just indicative of this movie having a director and a voice and something to say about who Elton is to his core, which is so nice. And that through line carries forth because it goes to show that Elton is such a supremely talented person throughout the whole movie, and like his struggles, it's so beautiful. It's just a great distillation of what the movie is saying about who Elton is. I just love that scene so much.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's definitely one where you can see Elton John's influence, maybe like on the worst side, where he's like, yes, I was a musical prodigy.
But like, that rocks.
I'm not saying it doesn't rock, but I feel like when you know how much of a creative force he was, and that's, I think, why the family stuff like bumps for me so hard, and why I actually like really don't like it, is because it feels very much like airing your dirty laundry, like in the first 30 minutes of this film. And it also sucks because like as soon as Taron Egerton shows up, the film rocks, but like that first act essentially is like rough to get through. What do you think, Eric? How do you feel about that? Because I feel like there's such a weird split between the two parts of that movie.
See, I didn't mind the kid and the preteen version. I mean, it's brief, thankfully, which is good. Even though, you know, the kid kind of comes back later in that moment and
in the pool.
I love the swimming pool sequence.
That's good.
Nice.
But no, like at the rehab or
yes, right. where he asked for the hug. Yeah,
which is one of those like it's a little too cringy for me.
Where everyone shows up. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't really need that. But again, this is a musical, and it's. This is what it would look like if it was a stage musical too, where, you know, everybody from, you know, the before kind of comes together.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of what it feels like anyway, is like a stage musical.
That would be a great show. I would love to see this as a stage show.
I mean, they did Moulin Rouge. There's no reason why they couldn't do this.
Oh my gosh.
No, I didn't mind it. I liked it because I liked the musical sequences of the home life. Although the first one, when the whole family is singing, is a little awkward. I think it's because not everybody has like a really great singing voice, but it's kind of what's good about it too.
I don't like it that much, but I do like the fact that not everyone has a good singing voice. Like, I think that I get that gets hit on a lot sometimes with reviews and stuff, but I think it adds something when a character's not supposed to have a good singing voice and they're singing. Like, I think that says something, and it's kind of nice. I don't know. I do enjoy
sure,
that. Like,
yeah.
With Richard Madden, I don't know if Richard Madden has the best singing voice. Maybe he does, but I love when he and Elton are, like, singing back and forth to each other, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I like that this... I like that Rocket Man fully commits to being a musical in all of the ways that musicals are musicals. It's not just, you know, a biopic with a little bit of flair. Like, it fully involves these other characters and involves these sequences and like takes musical sensibility to the just dialogue scenes as well. I respect that. That's commitment. We love commitment.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of now that we're here in Rocket Man territory,
Can we talk about
Jamie Bell?
Can we talk about Taron Egerton first?
We can talk about Taron first. Let's talk about Taron.
Let's then talk about talk him about first. Jamie.
Sure.
We're going to talk about Jamie Bell for like 5 hours.
No.
But
Taron is amazing.
Taron Egerton, I think, is so fucking good in this movie. And I think it, you know, sort of opposite from Rami Malek, it shows off his range.
Yes.
Because I think he's so good looking and he's so like young and hot. He could really easily be pigeonholed into like boring leading man territory. I think he's great in Kingsman, but like he's pretty, you know, down the middle in those movies as far as a character. But like,
these movies are weirdly horny.
Yeah, but also like somehow not horny enough. You know what I mean?
It verges almost on Austin Powers horny.
Like the first
second one. Yeah, the second. Yes, I agree. But yes, no, I think I agree. Keep going.
I think that he like has so much. He exhibits like so much range in this movie. I mean, I'm a big fan of him as an actor, so I'm probably like a little biased. But I think that this is such a lovely performance that. Like, he's able to play so many different emotions and different periods in his life, and he still feels like the same consistent character throughout. I just like how it's so clear how much he cares about this character and about this performance and about, like, what this film is achieving. And I don't even mean from, like, a seminal queer representation lens. I just mean, like, as a film, like you can really feel his dedication through the screen, in my opinion. And
well, I mean, his Edgerton's drama school like submission or song was Your Song, so his relationship to Elton John has been his entire career, and he has the range. He can sing.
He has the range.
Period. That's it. He has the range. He can do comedy and he can do romance and he can do drama and sad and happy and everything in between. And this is certainly one of those occurrences where I am okay with a non-queer person playing this role.
Absolutely.
Edgerton has this like built-in queer sensibility that is never ever like mimicry.
Mm-hmm.
The way that like some other people do.
Yes.
My friend Cody Derricks made this like super short video, and it's on his Twitter. I think it might even be like his pinned tweet. And it came right after this, or after Bo Rap. And it was, you know, every straight actor practicing to play a gay role. And it was just like doing as many like
limp wrist
that they can't, and it's so hilarious and true, because you can either adopt a sense of extremely familiar tropes to play a queer male character, or you can just embody a person and play them as a person and not as a construction board cutout.
Yes.
And that's what Edgerton does. It's totally him. He's not even impersonating Elton John.
Right. I feel like I mentioned earlier, his energy is like so right that it totally feels like the best kind of biopic performance, where it's not just like, you know, a trip down memory lane. It's not just a nostalgia fest. Like, he feels like he's bringing something new while also honoring this man in a really great way. I'm so glad you said that about like how non-queer actors approach queer roles, because I'm totally in the same boat as you. I don't need anyone that ever plays like a queer role to be queer in real life. Like, not to mention, if that was the case, we would literally never get any movies ever. But it's all about like the vibes. And I love how like he and Richard Madden look at each other in this. Like I said, even though their relationship goes bad.
I mean, how can you
bad,
not, if you're one of them, how can you not look at the other like
just
that?
Just major like heart eyes. But it feels so sincere. It feels committed. It doesn't feel like he's holding anything back or that he's afraid of like what this is going to do for him in the future, which I feel like is still kind of an accomplishment for actors that are taking queer roles, especially because he doesn't have to play like the tortured gay man. This is not like a tortured gay man movie where he has to reckon with like, you know, the horrible parameters and consequences of homosexuality. You know, like, he just can be who he is.
And I think that's it's so evident too in his relationship with Jamie Bell in the movie.
Yeah.
Because there is also an affection and an attention that is like a marriage.
Yes.
So, I mean, Edgerton as an actor treats the two really, really similarly. And that's treating them as just human relationships above anything else. And it's just another reason why it's really successful and why his performance is so successful, because he's so invested in those relationships, so you're invested in it.
Yeah.
I completely agree. The point on the limp wrist acting and everything, yeah. I just immediately thought of James Corden in The Prom, because it's so emblematic of just a straight actor thinking they know what a queer role is, which is the most infuriating thing,
yeah,
maybe of all time.
Not just, to go too into right, it, because
we're going to do an episode at some point, but it is just one of those things that it's just really, what really grinds my gears, as you were saying, where yeah. it just... It's why Taron is so successful, because he gives it a humanity, and yeah. it's not just, oh, I'm gay.
And the fact that we're like, oh my God, can you believe that he treats this person like an actual human and not like a caricature?
That's
it's just crazy.
But then it's like when you look at Rami and it's like, this is a caricature of like a queer person. Like, this is not mm-hmm. what a queer person is like at all.
And I think,
oh yeah, when he's at his party with the cape and the crown and stuff, and he's like, oh right, darling, right. And it's like, shut the fuck up,
right
you're a phony.
Exactly. I don't even think that it's so much like he thinks that this is like how he should play someone queer, but it definitely feels like he is imitating what he's seen and studied from Freddie Mercury tapes, instead of like actually imbuing the character.
Yeah. Cosplay.
Totally. Yes. I think it ties into what you said, Eric, that he has like a certain limit of range, and like outside of that, it gets very stiff. Yes.
With as you mentioned, the dynamic with Jamie Bell, I think where that succeeds is because, as you were saying, it's like not often in queer films do you have like male friendship portrayed on screen, and to have both this movie be about not only a queer character, but also queer, like male friendship is yes. like one of the most beautiful things. And the fact that it's done in such a strong way, because so many of the times it's like, we'll see, like we'll dig into it as well, as there's like an innate homoeroticism with these male friendships, where it's like, I hate you so much, or I love you so much, but in a straight way that it's gay, or, you know, all these different things. But there's never just a queer character and a straight friend of the same gender, and they can just be friends and just live in the same universe together. And to see that with this is so beautiful. And that's where I think, like, I think Jamie Bell excels, is because he is just so naturalistic within each scene. He just imbues this earnestness, and you just really believe that he cares so much about Elton, where Elton starts to think like no one loves him. But throughout the entire thing, you know that Jamie is just enraptured by him, as we were saying, like with the Crocodile Rock. Like, you see the enthusiasm that he has when Elton is being successful, and like just from that moment, no matter what going forward, you're going to believe that he's going to care about him. Even if he's nervous or whatever, you still believe that he loves him.
That diner scene between the two of them, oh, when they start, you know, just singing, and you can tell that they're so much on the same wavelength. I feel like that's one of the most like authentic friendship scenes that I have seen in a movie in a very long time.
So cute.
You immediately buy, you're like, of course they're going to be best friends forever. It's like you said, it's so naturalistic. Jamie Bell is one of the best in the business.
It's why that really short sequence when they have that fight, and he's like, they come to see Elton John, and I have cried like every time I watched it, when he's like, I'm sorry. And I'm just like, you don't just get those moments. You have to earn those moments, and their relationship earns that when yes. that happens. And it's so beautiful.
It's great.
Yeah. And I love that you buy that, like, they're not going to go more than 2 minutes without apologizing to each other, because that's just kind of the relationship that they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was saying, with Jamie Bell, just since we have you on, it's sort of mind-boggling that he's never really been given such a leading man performance to shine for, like, an Oscar-y sort of... Like, he's had sort of Oscar-baity movies. I mean, if you look, like, there's, like, Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, but that really kind of didn't go anywhere. But, I mean, throughout, like, his filmography, he's just so good in anything that he's in, even if it's a terrible movie. Like, Jumper he's in, but he's incredible in Jumper. Or, like, obviously King Kong, it's, like, that's such a, like, an ensemble piece, but Jamie Bell is sort of the audience surrogate for that movie, because he's like the young one going to this world with everyone else, and he's like, oh my god, I'm so excited to go to Skull Island, and you're like, oh my god, I love Jamie Bell and I want to go to Skull Island with you. But after like Billy Elliot was really like the one that like launched him and like was, I guess, like the only time when he's been giving a chance to really have that starring sort of awards baity performance. If that makes, like, I feel like he deserves more. Like, he's so consistent.
It's weird. I mean, he won the BAFTA as like a, you know, 13-year-old or whatever.
Right.
And yeah, it is really strange because he's had a very consistent career and a long one and has not, you know, suffered child star syndromes. But yeah, it never really got to that status. And I don't know if it's, I mean, he's kind of a small guy.
Right.
He's not a 6 foot like strapping dude.
He's Tintin.
Yeah, very much so. So I don't know if that was a factor. I mean, you can't, I don't know. I know most like actors are actually really short in real life. A lot of them are. And it's really, really funny to stand next to somebody and go, oh, you're fucking tiny.
Little.
I'm small, but you're tiny.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. He's not a traditional leading man. And I also feel like a lot of times he plays someone like very sensitive and very like open and just has like a real actorly quality to him, but something that I think can maybe push him into, because he's such like a giving performer, can push him into a giving role where he is supporting whoever is like, you know, getting the hero's journey or whatever. I have a lot of faith in Fred and Ginger, though. I feel like that is a legitimate star vehicle for him. And I'm excited. I'm so excited.
Who's Ginger?
Margaret Qualley.
Ooh, that's kind of fun.
It's so fun. And we know that they can both dance.
Right.
And we know that they can sing. And like they hit, you know, they hit a good happy medium of casting Hollywood people, but, you know, with a theatrical background. Yeah. And like, I mean, how do you cast that movie with bad dancers? You just,
yeah,
you can't.
It's weird because I think Tom Holland got the career.
Yes.
That Jamie Bell should have had.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that connection's weird too, because Tom Holland was
Billy Elliot on Broadway, musical. Right.
But that's the kind of trajectory that I had expected for Jamie Bell.
I completely agree.
Well, to maybe be just like blow up and be like in a superhero movie and all of these other kind of projects.
Yeah. It's also, the audacity of them sticking him in Fantastic Four as the Thing.
Well, that's the thing, is like some of his choices, they're frustrated because he's in Defiance, which like you would think would be a Daniel Craig actioner, doesn't really do anything. Jumper, you think it's going to be like a Hayden Christensen post Star Wars and it's going to blow up, doesn't do anything. He goes to do the Fantastic Four, completely flop. So it's like he has good performances, but the movies just don't do the work for him.
Bad luck.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, his smaller movies have been like Undertow. He's amazing in Undertow. That's a great film.
Huge Snowpiercer fan.
Oh my god, right.
Of him and Snowpiercer. Yeah.
I mean, he's good in Turn, : Washington Spies.
I literally can't. Yeah, he's the best. And, you know, I'm glad that we are appreciating him on mic as he deserves.
It's great. I mean, like, if you look at Billy Elliot too, like, dealing with, like, somewhat queer themes.
Oh,
you
absolutely.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, a young boy who's repressed and just wants to fucking dance.
Yeah.
So.
I have a funny Jamie Bell story.
Oh, do tell.
It just happened a couple of weeks ago, actually.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
So he follows me on Twitter, but he rarely, really posts. And my friend Jason was posting like these really great thirsty pictures of Jamie Bell. And so I replied, I'm like, I'm scared to like this post because I know he follows me. And then I added that like Christina Aguilera gif of her like clicking.
Yes.
A mouse. And like within 5 minutes, Jamie Bell liked that post. And then I went into his DMs and I'm like, God damn it, you got me. And he says, gotcha.
Oh,
it was hilarious.
That's amazing.
His Twitter is the gift that keeps on giving, because like he posts so rarely, but when he does, it's just like he's your internet friend from down the street. Mm-hmm. Who you like exchange words with every 100%. Once in a while.
Like, he's so on film Twitter. Like, he is so on film Twitter, but you know he's like
always
lurking.
Yeah.
He is a lurker, and that like proved it. I'm like, girl, that was 5 minutes ago. You were
watching. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
No, was so funny.
Oh my God. Good. That just makes me like him even more. He's what a so charming cool. guy.
He needs to be in more. He needs to be in more.
Congratulations, Kate Mara. You really got that.
I know.
Oh, absolutely. Good for her.
So happy for
them. Fantastic Four may have failed, but she succeeded.
And exactly. You know, from shitty movies, love is born. I always think about that with Michael Fassbender and Alicia Vikander.
Yes, yes.
Like, worst movie of all time.
It's not By the Sea. What's it called?
I don't even remember.
It's like
The light of the
Light Between Oceans.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, yes.
What if there was light between oceans, Brooke?
I mean, what if? Okay.
Anyways, back to Rocketman.
Back to Rocketman. Since we talked about the development and like the release and everything of Bohemian Rhapsody, let's like do a little backstory on Rocketman, because there was also some interesting casting choices pre-Taron Egerton.
Yeah, I'm glad we got what we got because yikes.
Please explain.
A great 1-2 punch of Justin Timberlake and Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy would be terrible, but I would love to see how unhinged it would be.
No, it would be so bad.
I know it would be terrible, but I would just love to know what it is. You
and
know
of
what
course,
I mean?
Justin Timberlake is a piece of shit.
Awful, terrible, yes.
Totally the wrong energy for this.
Oh my God, yeah.
I don't know what they were thinking.
That's the most straight, aggressive white male energy for a queer icon. Like, why Justin Timberlake?
It would be so
he
bad.
Never would have made out with Richard Madden, I can tell you.
Oh, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. But like from the beginning, Elton John and his husband, David Furnish, like struggled to get this off the ground because they wanted it to be R, and like people kept trying to bump it down to PG-13. And there's like an insane amount of censorship that happened with this movie after it came out. And I remember reading about this and be like, okay, so like homophobia is very alive and well. That's exciting. That's really good to know, considering that, like we said, Bohemian Rhapsody made almost $1 billion worldwide. And like you look at Rocketman, which was censored in Russia, in Malaysia, mm-hmm. in like totally banned in Samoa, and like commercial American airlines like Delta taking out all of the sex scenes and all of the kissing. And,
which is so minimal.
Yeah. But it's like, I think that we can say this because this is literally the crux of our podcast. Yeah. I think that the difference is that in Bohemian Rhapsody, it feels like a performance of what it's like mm-hmm. to be queer. Mm-hmm. And in Rocketman, it feels authentic. And that is what alarms people mm-hmm. because it feels like legitimate romance and not a performative, like, and now I will kiss this man because that is what the script has asked me to do.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And one is presented as a judgment and as condemnation
mm-hmm.
and the other is not.
It's just like the Hays Code, you know?
It is. The gaze code is back.
It's back.
It's such a good point. I completely had forgotten about all the censorship, but you're so spot on that it is specifically just about that this movie is depicting it in such a more human way. It's not just a spectacle. It's just, oh, here's human intimacy. Oh, God, people are going to be uncomfortable with it because it's real things and real emotions now.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
Do you think that Dexter Fletcher, because obviously he directed Taron and Eddie the Eagle, I feel like that might have had some weight to it.
For sure. They're familiar as right. like an actor-director combo. I think that this movie is very well directed. I'd like to see Dexter Fletcher do another musical. It is so crazy that he was like their pinch hitter for Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming he had what, like, was either mid-production on this or had just wrapped this.
For sure.
Just like... Yeah. I don't know. It's insane that for the most part, except for that 2-week overlap, these movies were made completely independently by different studios about different people and have beat for beat so many of the same sequences. And I think that having Dexter Fletcher as that pinch hitting director, like, obviously does not help that case. But like, it just blew me away how many of the beats are exactly the same. And you mentioned Walk Hard earlier, Jordan, which is obviously like a parody of the musical biopic. How much do you see that as like a 1-to-1 ratio? Because structurally, these movies are very similar. One is just executed much better.
With Bohemian Rhapsody, it's like in Walk Hard, like you think about your whole life before you perform. And that's literally what it's like with Live Aid. He's like, I'm going to think about like everyone and anything that's gone wrong in my life and all of my queerness, and then I will perform. And you're like, this was a parody. Like, what are you doing?
You should not take notes from right. this. Interesting. Okay, cool. I have yet to see the masterpiece that is Walk Hard.
Great movie.
So, oh, it's on the list.
It's great. It's fun.
I love John C. Reilly more than anything. Yeah.
Just at the end of the day, it is really just a one-to-one with this movie and Bohemian Rhapsody. They cover so much of the similar ground. It is just fascinating how the two roads literally do diverge at award season and at the box office and with audiences, because it just is indicative of American culture that one of them succeeds and one of them doesn't. And it sucks being a queer person in the world where the one that succeeds is the one that is not the one you want to.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, you get a lot of good stuff sometimes, but sometimes you get just like a real punch to the gut in terms of what succeeds and what fails and what is lauded and what is forgotten. So I hope that, you know, being able to look at these movies as a pairing, especially like down the road, maybe when the next crop of musical biopics comes around about like the early 2000s, people will remember Ooh. These and take notes, is all I'm saying.
Well, we have the Madonna biopic coming, mm-hmm. written and directed
by Madonna.
Now, I have a question for you, Eric. Do you think that Madonna's going to have any influence in what gets seen on screen in that movie, or it's going to be pretty like actual like digging into her life from a critical point of view?
It seems very objective.
It's insane.
I mean, I hate that I just deviated from our conversation.
This is good. This is important.
It's going to be something that is heavily, heavily scrutinized. And the knives are already out for it because of her previous directing. And, you know, people are very cautious about biopics that have so much influence by the people that they're about, that there will be no objectivity whatsoever. And I hope that there is. I think there might be. I mean, I'm as big a fan of hers as you can possibly get, but I'm also completely aware that she is a very strange person now. And I do worry. I'm glad that Diablo Cody is her co-screenwriter on that, because I think, and just watching her Instagram stories about it, that there will be some leveling out of potential truths and things like that. I think based on all that, it looks like it's going to be like end in 96 at Evita. And right before she has her first child, which I think is exactly the right thing to do. That was at the peak of her powers. And then it also doesn't, you know, keeps her kids out of it. I think it's really smart. And it looks like that's what's going to happen. Obviously I'm really excited for it. Universal is backing it, which is pretty amazing. And I think everyone's going to pay a lot of attention to like who's playing Sean Penn and who's going to be, you know, all of these other people. I hope it's cool and weird. I hope it is at least somewhere in the middle between Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man.
Right.
Obviously leaning more to one than the other. Probably going to lean a little more to Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
We'll see, you know, what Universal is okay with. But, I mean, she's the director. So I don't think it would have been made without her. I mean, that's obviously her demand. So I have hope.
I do too. And look, she obviously, like, whatever else you want to say, she has, like, obviously she's very involved performance-wise. I'm sure it's going to be visually and I would say, like, sequentially very... very stunning. I'm obviously very excited to see who's gonna play her. Do you remember when Anne Winters was recreating all those looks of hers on Instagram? And like, I respect it so much, but it hurts that Universal was like, try.
Yeah. No, that was so fun. Yeah. I was stalking Madonna's Instagram, which I do already. And every time she would like start to follow a new actress and be like, oh,
who is this?
Oh, what's up, Julia Garner? You know, everybody. And then like Dumois like posted that thing where, oh yes, Florence Pugh has been offered the role. And I'm like, no, she hasn't. And that's directly from Madonna's publicist. So you're wrong.
Yeah.
Like that would not be great casting, honestly.
But she is like one of the the front runners, which is not surprising. I mean, she's like the hottest shit in Hollywood.
With what you're saying, I feel like it all boils down to, as we're talking about, like music biopics and sort of how do you adapt someone's story within the music industry, or at least like historical biopics, even if, with them involved. And it's like, I think at this point, we have reached such a surplus of music biopics that it does, in order for them to succeed on a critical level, there has to be some sort of, not authorship, but just like artistic statement and purpose behind them and like having a visual style. And I think that people are exhausted by the books numbers of seeing an entire life story. Like, we don't want a whole life story. Like Lincoln, I don't know why I just thought of Lincoln, but I guess like where Lincoln succeeds is because it is like such a snippet of his life, or with Rocketman, how it doesn't go through his whole life, and Bohemian Rhapsody sort of, while it doesn't go through his whole life, it does give that energy of like, here is the entire story of Freddie Mercury, where Rocketman, you do see him as a kid, but it does feel a little more contained for what it's worth, even if it is starting out with him as a kid. And I think that where they succeed is like Rocketman has like a visual style and it is like much more focused on like a specific journey. And I feel like that's how music biopics and biopics going forward really need to excel. It's like, no one wants to see the you're born here and you die here anymore. Like, it's exhausting.
We want a thematic.
I think there's a big move to that where things are slice of life sections, because it's just simply easier to accommodate and accomplish. Because if you do a life-spanning biopic of somebody, you're going to leave stuff out and people are going to be like, you left that out. And if you just focus on a small part, then you can hopefully do it a little more efficiently. And I think we'll see a whole lot more of that. Anything from like King's Speech was like that, Darkest Hour was like that. And then it doesn't have to be a biopic of a person's life. It's a moment in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's can be good, but it still has to be a good movie. Because, yeah. I mean, I think Darkest Hour is not a good movie. Yeah. I don't think The Iron Lady is a good movie.
Judy is like very moment.
Judy is not great either, but
What happens is
once you have them, there's not going to be another, you know, musical biopic of Queen and Freddie Mercury at this point.
Oh God, no.
And a lot of times, especially when you're talking about musical ones, you're not even going to make them without the explicit approval of the state or of the person. You don't have the rights to their song, so there's no point in making a musical biopic if you don't.
The David Bowie one, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That forces the hand of the screenwriter and the director to completely bend to the tone and the content of it. I forgot the Whitney Houston biopic is greenlit and coming. Mm-hmm. And that's completely
Elvis.
With approval of the Whitney Houston estate. So I mean, what's that going to look like?
I'm interested to see how that tackles sexuality also.
Yeah.
And if there's like,
yes,
even a mention of it. Yeah,
exactly. We had those two competing Whitney Houston documentaries that happened within a year of each other, and they both have a very different approach to her sexuality and relationships. And the one that was backed by the estate is the much softer, sidelined version. So why would the movie not be? It's going to be too.
Yeah. God, it's actually fascinating.
I'm excited for Baz's Elvis just because I love how unhinged Baz is. So
sure.
I just really hope that there's just like, I mean, I won't lie. I'm fully in the Baz camp. I think Gatsby's a masterpiece.
Oh, no.
Moulin Rouge is a masterpiece. Romeo and Juliet. I mean,
Jordan,
man, I know.
You know how much
I know,
love
but
Baz
that's why
Norman.
I'm like, I feel like I'm just interested because Elvis feels so, I just, it's hard to think of Elvis's music and think of Baz in the same framework, which is why I'm like so interested to see how he approaches the visuals and the songs, because it just doesn't feel like the two mesh, which is why I'm fascinated.
Yeah, me too.
I'm probably a little more on the fence than the two of you, but look, I'll go see anything and everything. And if it surprises me, then like, great. I love that.
Maybe Tom Hanks will sing.
Oh yeah.
I'm into directors going and tackling things that don't seem like their wheelhouse, because yes. No, I can love Martin Scorsese, but I will take his non-gangster stuff over his gangster stuff almost any time now, because he is a really fantastic director. But when he goes outside of that, of the things that he's the most, you know, known for or familiar with, is when I think he is the most exciting. So I think that'll be really cool. I mean, what Baz Luhrmann did with Great Gatsby was totally fucking insane.
Yeah.
And that's the energy that I want to see in Elvis too.
Same. Yes. Unhinged energy is what he brought.
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff on the horizon.
There's so much. I just have a point for you, actually.
Okay.
Within Rocket Man, Brooke famously is a fan of newspaper montages. So I wanted to ask how you felt about the Rocket Man newspaper montage, where like we got the newspapers sort of spinning in and the headlines popping up.
3 out of 5. It's good. It didn't blow me out of the water, but I do like it. I like it a lot more than the weird neon city business that's going on in Bohemian Rhapsody, which I think is so boring.
A mess.
But it is again one of those like consistencies between the two films.
Right.
Like, yes, we are still working within the framework of what is familiar and what you're expecting to see, and montages and passages of time for these kind of things. This is how you do it. You do those, you know, fade in, fade out highlights of all the cities, or you do newspaper. And there's really or, you know, the billboard chart climb and all of these kind of things. There's so little that's really offered to a musical biopic to tell information super quickly and pass time super quickly than that. So I generally don't mind it so much, because it saves from exposition and just extra time.
And that's why it's interesting to see exciting directors take this on, because maybe Baz Luhrmann will be like, fucking newspaper montage.
I got
something better. And actually, who are we kidding?
Right, Baz is going to have like a 10-minute newspaper montage.
Maybe he'll pull a Romeo and Juliet and do like insane zooms on to like make up some sort of crazy stringing together.
With directors, sorry, quick
no,
point.
Go.
But with her, I was just thinking about Her Smell with what you were just saying and how it sort of like charts a climb. And I feel like what's so fascinating about this movie, obviously it's a made up musician, but I would love to see that sort of approach to an actual music biopic, where it's like you're with her for like one part of this, like the whole first act is like daring you to turn it off, and you're just like so uncomfortable with Elizabeth Moss. And then it hard cuts and it's just, you have just, her whole life has completely changed. And then it's just that portion. And then it's one thing for a comeback. And it's, you don't dig into like the climb or anything. It's just gives you what you need. And then it goes to another little bit. And I would love to see a biopic sort of have that approach, where it's just gives you all you need. And it just eliminates the montage, eliminates all this fluff. Like that, like obviously, because it was indie and because it was not about like a real life person, it's working within that, but that would be so beautiful to see something like that.
I think it would be very easy, because obviously the audience will have the pre-existing knowledge that this band became like the biggest, you know, group in the world at one point. But like, I don't think that that's ever going to happen because that's such an integral part of like, what is a music biopic? People want to have that montage. They want to see the rise to power.
Mm-hmm. They don't want anything outside what they're familiar with. They just want to hear the songs.
Yeah.
Greatest hits album, whatever.
And one day we'll get a Beatles one.
Oh,
which I'm sure will be not by the numbers at all.
Wow.
Anyways,
I don't even want to think about that. Anyway, this has been Musical Biopic Breakdown with Brooke and Jordan and Eric. Wow, I think that was great. We covered a ton of ground, and we already touched on box office, actually. Let's see, $700 million gap between the two of them, which
is so scary.
Literally nuts. But also Bohemian Rhapsody was like such an outlier, and I do think that like it's very hard for a biopic to achieve that level of like
totally
international blowout, which is why it like left such a unfortunate cultural impression. But
that's
hey,
wild.
There you go.
How many people, I wonder, someone do the math online, but I wonder what the difference is, like how many people, if you break down the box office, what it would be like this many more people saw,
like basically
Bo-Rap versus Rocketman.
How many people is $700 million dollars?
Yeah. Because it's a probably scary number that I don't want to think about.
Let me see if I can do this for you. Because let's say for the sake of argument, it's $20 a ticket. That is a difference of 35 million people, I think.
Worldwide.
Yeah. 35 million more people worldwide saw.
That tracks.
Bohemian Rhapsody. But don't forget that crazy portion of Stan Twitter that was like, I have seen Bohemian Rhapsody 30 times and I will see it 30 more. I would not see my favorite movie in the world 30 times within a theatrical run.
Mm-mm.
It's again, I don't think anybody anticipated the response that the movie got.
No.
And like you said, from all ages. It wasn't just, you know, boomers really happy to see a Queen movie. It was all ages, and it hit multiple quadrants.
Four quadrant, baby. Yeah. Yes. Guess
not the queer one.
Exactly.
Missed it by a lot.
And Rocketman decided to sacrifice some of those quadrants for the queer quadrant. And you know what? We stand. We have to stand.
And, I mean, for what it's worth, Rocketman was still a hugely successful movie.
Totally. Yes.
And like a normal successful biopic.
Yeah.
Made plenty of money. Made all of its money back. Is a hit.
Right. Just wasn't the most successful biopic of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even just the US numbers are tremendous for its budget. So there was nothing lost on that, which is a good thing, because even in the face of Bohemian Rhapsody's money, it did show that there is an audience for a different type of music biopic and a musical within, you know, a modest budget. And I still think what Fletcher did with $40 million is fucking incredible.
Oh my God. Yeah, the visual sequences aren't, the music, each big music number just blows me away. Like, I'm forgetting which the song it is, but him and Richard Madden, basically like their falling in love song, where they open up the doors to the little house and you go through, and then you have the whole musical number there. Like, all of the bits are so pleasant and enjoyable. It's just great. It's visual style and flair.
Yep.
That, the sequence at the circus, the transitions from, you know, when he's little and playing the piano and then nod and running through the alleys and the cars. That's a lot of work.
Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting rocks. Yeah. Like, I'm like, I'll go fight. Let's go.
Fletcher has great musical sensibilities. I like hope that his next project or like a future project is like a musical, maybe like on a little bit of a bigger budget. Look, he is a director that they should hire to do something like a Disney live action remake. Like, he clearly has those musical sensibilities and he knows how to command a budget.
Aladdin.
Yeah, dude, I don't get me started. On Guy Ritchie's Aladdin, but
yeah,
such is life. But hey, I hope that he's on an upward trajectory. And honestly, it feels really great because Bryan Singer is toast.
Trashed.
Yeah,
good. Bye.
As he should be. Yes. Like, obviously, if people want to look into it, like, go for it. He's the worst human being to ever live. But it's nice to see like Dexter Fletcher like succeed at coming out of this musical, and Taron Egerton too. He's got Little Shop coming up, which is great. Let's see him in a musical. I know. Let's not.
Okay, we won't go.
Let's not get into it.
We'll hold it. I love Little Shop.
Oh,
so
yeah, I know you do.
Yeah, me too.
It's
yeah.
just I don't know if he gives the right energy
because he's sexy.
Yeah, because he's hot.
Normcore.
Yeah. You know, and you know, after Jake Gyllenhaal did it, you know, that's all I would really want to see. So I'm a little disappointed.
It's tough. Anyways, sorry.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I just am happy for him.
No, we're happy for Taron. We're happy. Anything Taron gets, we're invested. We have our stock in Taron.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bought
yeah,
money absolutely. In Taron stock at the Kingsman days.
And oh, absolutely.
It has never
invested
done
early.
Me wrong.
It's just been rising.
Yes. Robin Hood was a bit of a dip, but that's okay. We'll forgive him.
What movie?
Oh, I'm sorry. A movie that does not exist.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know this Robin Hood fellow.
Steampunk Robin Hood.
Anyways.
All right.
Shall we guess the letters?
Jordan, go ahead and guess the letterbox rating.
Eric, do you want to have a guess?
Feel free to throw in a guess if you would like.
Wait, who? Oh.
So
yeah.
He has right now?
Yeah, so Jordan, at the end of every episode, tries and guesses the average Letterboxd rating, because Letterboxd is, unfortunately, for better or for worse, a very big part of our lives. And sometimes they're very surprising. For example, I think these are very surprising.
Oh,
so
no, really?
Why don't we kick it off with Bohemian Rhapsody?
Okay.
Jordan, you go ahead, and then Eric, if you want to throw in a guess, go ahead.
Okay.
You just said that they're surprising, and now my whole
brain
is melting.
Don't let that
I won't let it
influence your decision.
I gave it very low, but I know that there's a world out there where people really enjoyed it. I'm going to unfortunately go Bohemian Rhapsody has a 3.8. I'm going to say, wait, no, I feel like that's, I can't go that high. Maybe it is that high. I don't know. I'm nervous. 3.4. Yeah, I'll say it has a 3.4. Eric?
The thing that's good about Letterboxd, at least for right now, is that it hasn't been overly invaded by crazies the way that Rotten Tomatoes.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Even before you said that, my thoughts would be that for Bohemian Rhapsody, it would be a little bit lower because it's not going to be crazy fans that are voting. So I would probably go 3.2.
Okay.
Guys?
Can I actually change? Oh.
No, you want to change?
No. I'll keep it.
Okay.
But that even seems high.
It's a 3.3. So right in the middle of you
hey,
two.
Hey, we split the difference.
It's a 3.3, but let me just say, a lot of people gave this like 2 stars, 3 stars. There is a huge chunk of people that gave this 5 stars.
Yeah,
it is, there is a big block of 5, which is so
weird.
They
found it. So they found Bohemian Rhapsody on Letterboxd.
Yes.
There was one person who I followed who gave it an ironic 5 stars, and I was mad because I'm like, no, you're boosting the average. What are you doing?
That's like some Sanjaya level trolling.
Yeah.
Yes.
Irony never helped anybody when it comes to statistics.
Okay. Rocket Man.
Rocket Man.
I'm shooting for darts here. I'm just going to say it is a 3.6 and it's just a smidge higher. I'm not going to say that it is that much higher, though.
3.6?
3.6.
Eric, care to hazard a guess? You absolutely don't have to. I never guess.
Oh, no, I'm going to guess.
This is actually the hardest ones that I've had to do because comparing the two has just warped my brain.
If I was that close for Bohemian Rhapsody, that does follow my thought process of how Letterboxd is different than IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, at least so far. And I know that Rocket Man was within smaller circles of film fans regarded as a better movie. So I have to think it's a little bit higher just because of that, but probably not much.
Mm-hmm.
Like 3.5.
3.5? It's a 3.7.
Wow.
Good.
So
I said 3.6.
You said a 3.6.
Good.
Hey.
You guys are very close. Very close.
I'm honestly good for Rocket Man.
Thank God it has a higher.
Right. Yeah. Literally at the end of the day, that's all I need.
And it's higher by a solid amount. But definitely, for example, 220 people logged it on Letterboxd as a watch, 511,000 people logged Bohemian Rhapsody. So there's a lot more traction. But like we said, it tracks. Let's wrap it up here. Obviously, I think it's pretty clear how we feel about these movies, but just for peace of mind, let's give our Queer Quadrant ratings out of 5 stars. I can kick it off.
Go
if you'd
for
like.
It. I would
okay,
love for you to
great.
Lead.
Let's make this short and sweet. Bohemian Rhapsody, literally 1 star. It is so bad. I can't give it 0.5 star though, because still a queer lead character, even if they totally erased his own self-proclaimed bisexuality and
Freddie, you're gay.
Numerous articles on the fact that he identified as bisexual, but whatever. 1 star, goodbye. I never want to talk about it ever again. Also, fuck Bryan Singer. Thank you and good night.
Amen, sister.
Rocket Man, I am going to, let's see. You know what?
Are you going to go the direction I think I'm going to go to?
5 stars.
Yes!
Because
let's go.
However you feel about the quality of the movie in general, I feel like the depiction of a gay on screen, lead character is amazing and obviously coming from such a great place. And I just don't know what else I would ask for, especially given like the parameters of Elton John making, you know, being so involved himself. Like, this is clearly exactly what he wanted. And I think that it is a really important like piece of representation. And I just love everything that it's doing in that realm. So there we go.
I completely agree.
Jordan?
1 star for Bohemian Rhapsody. I would go half star. You know what? Fuck it. Half star.
Wow.
I can't stand this movie. It really upsets me. The fact that I rewatched it was a bad experience. Half star. And I just, I've talked about it up top, but I mean, like, as you've already dug into, this movie really does not like the queer community. And I would have loved to have seen a Freddie Mercury biopic directed by a queer person or just by someone who understands and likes the queer community. And for that fact that it wasn't, and it's so blatant and its disregard for queer lives is infuriating. So half star. Rocketman, 5 stars, baby. Let's go. I mean, I agree. Like, look, it's not a perfect movie by any means or anything like that. But in terms of representation, hell yeah. I mean, look, Taron, great. Jamie, great. What it has to say is nice. As we had mentioned, it's the first film by a major studio to include a gay male sex scene. There's Brokeback, obviously, but that is focusing on specifically like a queer story. This is just sort of about something else.
Biopic.
Like, it's a music biopic. And for Paramount to be like, look, we'll give it an R rating, fuck that the MPAA gave it an R rating. But for it to sort of include this queerness and to be just about Elton and include his queerness in just such a free way and to be humanist about its portrayal, it's 5 stars, baby. It's nice to see, you know, queer people on screen.
It is nice.
It's great.
It's very nice.
So
makes me happy.
Eric?
So I just looked at my letterbox to see if I had even graded these, and I had done Rocketman, but I had not done Bohemian Rhapsody. So I just did it before you went, Jordan. And we are sisters there because I also did half a star. Because it's really all that it's worth.
Yeah.
And if the movie had not been a big financial success or a big award success, I would probably be a lot less harsh on it. But I honestly think it's a really dangerous movie because its reach was so broad. And if it had been really small and had a small audience, its impact would not be the same. And so I think it devalues and it defames Freddie Mercury's life in a way that is just, it's just cruel and it's unnecessary. So, I mean, it barely deserves a half a star. It only deserves that for just being, you know, having some good music. Mm-hmm. But it is a chore to sit through. It's painful. It's ugly.
Yes.
It's well shot. It is the worst edited movie in memory. It barely earns that half star. Barely.
Yeah.
It's scraping for it.
Yeah.
And you know, Bryan Singer deserves nothing, so.
Yes, except the trash.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Oh, and as a sidebar on Singer, it's pretty horrible how willing everybody was to reward the film, but very specifically exclude him from it as if they were making some kind of like statement, when no, you were still supporting this movie by this horrible person, and fuck you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sidebar done there.
No, very important.
Important to say.
Yeah. But so then I did already have my Rocketman score, and that was 4.5 stars. And I totally stand exactly by that. It's like I said, it's not absolutely perfect, and that's just the tiny little bit shaved off of it, but it's exuberant and it's vibrant and it's fun and it's sad and it's beautiful and it's everything that it should be. It's everything. It's the good and the bad. I love it. I think it is something that will, as time goes, be much better received historically than Bohemian Rhapsody, because I think it's inevitable that one conversation about one will bring up the other. I think it's almost always going to happen. It is, again, like the Armageddon Deep Impact. You know, it's, you can, if you talk about one, the other is already there.
Yep.
or the volcano movies or whatever, anything like that. So I think the esteem for it will constantly rise, and history just will look extremely, extremely kind on it.
I agree. Yeah. And that's all, you know, that's what we can hope for at this point. And I do think that it is like on that trajectory, which is great. Okay.
Makes me happy.
Let's see. What do we do next?
So, well, I guess, Eric, I mean, thank you so much for coming on.
What a delight to have you and your expertise and all of your awards watch knowledge. And thank you again for recommending this incredible pairing, honestly.
Should we add? Do you have any, since we're on the record here?
Yes.
Do you have any award season takes for the year 2021?
Like, give us your hottest award season take. One that you stand behind, but one that you think is a little off the beaten path.
Oh my gosh.
Not to put you on the spot. You don't have to answer.
But, you know,
we are recording this the day of the Golden Globes before they happen. And I think there's going to be some potentially really crazy, awkward, and awful things that happen tonight.
Most likely.
Can't wait.
I mean, there almost always is for the Globes anyway, but, you know, just in this last week, all of the extra scandals, you know, heaped on top of them, from the Emily in Paris trips to how much the members are paid,
yep,
to the really big thing that was revealed, and that's that they haven't had a Black member in 20 years. There's only 87 members of the group anyway, and they're all like super secretive, and it's really weird. There is no list. You don't know. Nobody knows who all 87 members are, ever. And we never even know how membership happens, because it always stays within about five people. So it's like, do you have to die and then somebody gets in, or how does that even work?
It's the most unhinged show.
It's absolutely bananas.
So there's been like a whole lot of weird things with, you know, a lot of celebrities, you know, posting Time's Up Globes, but they're also going to be presenters tonight. So it's a really kind of awkward. And then they just revealed yesterday that they're going to make some kind of statement on the show about that, which is going to be kind of a first time thing, because the Globes don't give a shit about their reputation. They really never have.
No.
So I don't know if this is going to change a lot of things, but I kind of hope that it does. They are 78 years old. They are embedded in Hollywood as much as anything possibly could be. So without the external forces of white Hollywood putting pressure on them, there is no impetus for them to change. So I think if they can make some kind of changes, we'll see what's already happened with the Oscars and with BAFTA, of trying to make some really dramatic and very real and impactful changes to how awards are done. But that's the top level down, and those changes need to happen at an executive and a green lighting level. So I do think that what's going to happen from awards, and it's not really, I guess, a hot take about something specific, it's that I think whatever happens with the Globes and the Oscars this year, we will see not just an effort to create a more diverse group of films that we see represented, but at the executive producing green lighting level. Mm. And that's going to change what we see at awards then for the years to come from there. I mean, the Oscars are implementing something in 2 years that I think it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's really dramatic. And that would be like enough for a whole like episode to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's pretty dramatic of what it's going to take to get a Best Picture nomination. You have to check off a whole lot of boxes, and some of them are actually super questionable how you would even enforce them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that's the aside. So I think the thing that we're going to see, and the hottest take from this, is that what happens tonight at the Golden Globes should be a snowball effect. Mm. If it's not, that's going to suck. And then it's a lot of business as usual, but I think we will see a big snowball effect after tonight.
And by the time that you're hearing this, you will know.
The ball will be rolling.
If there is a snowball. That's why we love podcasts.
I have to know. I have to ask. Do you think Hamilton wins anything?
Yeah, I do. I think because it's in competition with Borat mostly,
yeah,
those two will kind of go back and forth. So it's either, I think it'll either be like Hamilton wins comedy musical and Sacha Baron Cohen wins actor, or the opposite.
Vice versa. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be like just one of them.
Mm-hmm. Your awards watch, like Globes Rundown, was my primary source for putting together my predictions for tonight. So
very excited.
I am very excited.
I put a lot of thought into it. I mean, it drives me crazy when I go to people's predictions and it's like, here's like one sentence and here's all the predictions. I'm like, I want to know why. I want to know why you're doing it.
Yes.
Give me the reason.
Although I have to say, I was a big fan of Best Animated Feature. Come on.
I'll say this. That could absolutely bite me in the ass, because last year they did not go for Toy Story 4 and they went for Missing Link, which mm-hmm. was a massive shock. So I'm
that screwed my bracket last year.
I said that to be kind of funny and shady, but I know how that can bite me in the ass tonight.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the fun of awards predictions.
With the Globes, it's like you take a shot and then you make your guess, because it's like, I don't, who freaking knows?
Who can predict?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, good time.
Messy.
Anyway.
You're the best in the biz.
Yes. It's you're great. It. You are truly like my number one go-to, and many others for awards watching. And we're so delighted that you were able to come and talk some awards and also talk some movies with us. Is there anything that you would like to plug?
Gosh, well, yeah, you know, just come to awardswatch.com. It's really going to be a crazy couple of months now after the Globes. Everything just kind of is going to steamroll from there. So there's going to be a lot of content, a lot of nominations, a lot of shows, a lot of stuff. It's going to be a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't usually use sports references too much, but that's what Monday is going to look like. It'll be like, how did that happen? And what does it mean? And that's what all of tomorrow is going to look like.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, so come there and follow me on Twitter at awards_watch. I say a lot of really crazy things that are not awards related. Lots of thirsty things, lots of weird things. And you know, you might get Jamie Bell's attention.
I was gonna say.
Hey. Look, at the end of the day, that's a win. So
and that's really all we want. Our primary contact is Twitter as well. I'm at Brooke B. Solomon.
At Jordan H. Gus.
And we are together at Queer Quadrant. You can find this podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate, review, subscribe, tweet at us, tweet at Jamie Bell, but only if you tweet nice things about us.
And Jamie Bell, come on the podcast.
Oh my God.
We would love to have you.
Big fan if you're listening. but yes, that is where you can find us.
So we're exiting the stadium. It was a pretty good concert. And, you know, I think, you know, this is the end of March. We're coming up on something special. What do we have cooking in April, Brooke?
We have a very exciting announcement for the month of April. There's an important birthday in April. The birthday of one of our finest undervalued actors, Channing Tatum. And to that point, we are doing a whole month of Channing Tatum movies.
Let's go.
It is Chatting Channing 2021. We are very excited about it. Throughout the month, we will be covering four of his biggest and potentially queer quadrant-est hits with some very exciting guests. I, for one, am thrilled. And I would just like to shout out that in preparation for this insane undergoing, Jordan has watched every single yes. Channing Tatum movie.
Yes, I am three away from finishing the entire Channing Tatum filmography. I am putting together my list of best and queerest, and if there's a correlative between the two, you'll have to stick around to find out, but I am very excited for this.
Jordan has like a bunch of red string and tape up on the walls all over yes. his apartment, you know, pictures of Channing Tatum. I did not do that because
You're smart.
I do not have the stamina that you do.
I wake up in the night screaming Channing Tatum.
I am very excited to talk about him with our guests. It's going to be a great time. So tune in next week for our kickoff with Magic Mike.
Jazz hands, baby.
The original. It's going to be a great time. So yeah, that's basically all the news that's fit to print, or all the music that's fit to be sung. But you know, I want to leave this with my favorite redeeming moment from Bohemian Rhapsody, if you can believe that I'm even saying that.
Oh my God.
But the fact that Freddie Mercury creates a house with rooms for each of his individual cats is something that we personally would like to aspire to.
Great
Would you
point.
Agree?
Great point.
We're going to get started on it right now.
I'm with you on that. As a cat dad, I would do the same exact thing.
Great. So we're all going to go in on mansion construction. I'll get you the details.